You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the years leading up to his suicide in 1975, George Price gave away everything he owned to a group of homeless men living in a seedy section of London. Mr. Price, a brilliant mathematician, had become an evangelical Christian after developing an equation that explained for the first time how altruism could be understood in relationship to Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection. Orrin Harmon examines the troubled genius's life and achievements in his new book called The Price of Altruism. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Orrin Harmon to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Wasn't the contradiction between the idea of survival of the fittest and evidence that individuals throughout history have performed acts of kindness at some cost a problem that Charles Darwin himself hadn't been able to resolve?
Well, Charles Darwin called it the greatest riddle and the greatest challenge to his theory. He knew that if he couldn't solve this problem, then his theory wasn't worth anything. And he considered in particular the social insects, and in particular the barbed sting of the bumblebee, because the bumblebee, as everyone knows, in protecting the hive, pays the greatest price in order to save its fellow mates.
Because it kills itself when
it kills itself. And Darwin, having come up with the idea of natural selection, knew that that was a paradox, because if evolution is a game of survival of the fittest, how could behaviors that reduced fitness survive over time? Why weren't they kicked out by the ruthless cull of natural selection? So this was a great paradox and has been ever since Darwin.
How many scientists tried following the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859 to explain the role that altruism played in the continued survival of the species?
Many, and many from very different kinds of fields. There were ecologists, there were geneticists, there were game theorists, there were psychologists, there were economists. Each tried to attack this problem from their own direction and their own approach, and each came up with different answers.
Well, the answer that most came up with, I'm sure, was that these kinds of behaviors made sense because they were actually self-serving in one way or another.
That wasn't the solution that Darwin came up with. Darwin actually thought that these kinds of acts of sacrifice were good for the community, so that selection, the unit of selection, was not the individual, the selfish individual, but rather the community or the group.
Oh, in some cases, the group enforces that. Remember reading about ants that sometimes rebel and decide to reproduce even though they're not supposed to be the ones who reproduce, and the rest of the colony gets them. They kill them.
Right, right.
I mean, I don't know whether an ant is aware of the fact that he's putting his life on the line when he decides to go off and make whoopee, but there are other reasons why some people will stay in line.
Right. Well,
ants will, but people as well.
I don't know if ants are aware either. I don't think anyone knows whether no one has been able to get into the mind of an ant. But the definition of biological altruism is any kind of action which bestows a fitness benefit on the other while paying a fitness cost. So biological altruism really has nothing to do with intention. It doesn't even suppose mind. There need not be mind for biological altruism. And in fact, there are incredible instances of altruistic amoeba. So it's something different from psychological altruism, which is what we talk about when we talk about altruism amongst humans.
Well, when somebody, a soldier, throws himself onto a hand grenade to protect the rest of the people in his company, for example.
Exactly, which is a great mystery. You know, we really all want to understand the deep motivations behind acts of kindness and the ultimate acts of sacrifice. And it's very difficult to plumb these depths.
Was George Price the first person to tackle altruism as a mathematical problem?
No, he wasn't. The first person to do that was Bill Hamilton, who was later called the Darwin of the 20th century, a great figure, Englishman, who came up with an equation himself in the mid-60s based on a theory that he came up with called kin selection. And what that very short equation said was that there was a direct relationship between genetic relatedness and altruism. If you take two organisms, the closer they are genetically, the more altruism you will find between them. So George wasn't the first, but George, out of nowhere, not having been trained as a biologist or even as a mathematician, a kind of cross between a Rain Man character and Forrest Gump. He was a man who was born in this city in 1922 in New York City, and who found himself in very strange ways at the center of different scientific revolutions, always solving some difficult problem and then disappearing like a phantom. So he had worked at the Manhattan Project during World War II, working as a chemist on uranium enrichment. He then took a 90-degree turn and went to work with Shockley and Bardeen on transistor research at the telecommunications revolutions in the middle of the century. He worked as a cancer researcher, then invented computer-aided design for IBM, although it didn't take out a patent. And then finally, quite late in life, at the age of 45, following a botched thyroid operation, had a breakdown. And the breakdown led to his decision to leave everything behind. He'd already divorced his wife and left his family, but to leave his family, his job, his country, and to come over to England to try to solve this great mystery, ever since Darwin, of the evolution of kindness. So George arrives in London in the winter of 1967, completely unknown, unaffiliated, and begins reading the papers, the relevant scientific papers on the evolution of altruism in the late opening public libraries. And he comes across Hamilton's paper, and he writes him a letter, and he says, "Hello, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is George Price, and I've come to solve the problem of altruism." And Hamilton obviously had no idea who this man was, but was an English gentleman and sent him back a reprint.
Well, had Hamilton felt that he had already solved the problem?
Well, Hamilton knew that his solution was partial, because we know that there are many instances in nature where there are altruistic acts between non-related individuals. And so kin selection could only explain a portion of the altruism that we see in nature. So he knew that it wasn't a complete solution. But when he received this sort of unsolicited letter from George Price, he sent back a reprint and said, "You know, I'm off to the jungles of Brazil to study social wasps," and didn't think of it again. Then half a year later, returned to his desk in London and found on his desk what became known as the Price equation.
And he and another man, John Maynard Smith, are among the major supporters of Price.
Right. So to continue the story, what happened was that when Price himself came up with this equation, he sort of couldn't believe that he was the one to come up with this equation, because all the great minds since Darwin, including Darwin himself, had been trying to crack the great riddle. And he walked off the street into UCL, into the biology department, and showed it to the professor and said, "Is this new?" And within 5 minutes had keys to an office and an honorary professorship, one of the greatest genetics departments in the world. And then went home and began to think about what had just happened. And as I said, he was a Rain Man character, so numbers meant a lot to him. And he began to tabulate mathematically all the coincidences that he perceived had happened to him in his life, because he thought of this as a great coincidence. And he came up with an unbelievable number, 1 divided by 10 to the 30th. And it included coincidences like that he had 4 girlfriends whose name was Anne, or that the last 4 digits of his phone number were 2399, which meant to him a minute before midnight. Very strange things. And the number was so astronomical, the probability so improbable, that although a staunch atheist, a rationalist scientist, he ran out of his apartment directly into All Souls at Langham and became an evangelical Christian.
My guest is Orrin Harman, H-A-R-M-A-N. His latest book, The Price of Altruism, George Price, and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. It's published by Norton. Well, can you give us an idea of how this equation worked, which is also called the covariation equation? Can it be explained to people like me who can barely add up a column of figures?
It's actually called the covariance equation, and it's actually a very, very simple mathematical relationship. It just tells you how a trait changes from one population to the next, or in time from one generation to the next, as a function of the relationship between that trait and the fitness of the organism bearing that trait. So it's a very, very, it's actually a mathematical tautology, but it lays bare the elements of natural selection in such a way so as to be able to be very, very useful in looking at the evolution of traits where there's a conflict between the interest of the individual and the interest of the group. And I'll give you an example to make this easy. Think of a virus invading a host. Now, if natural selection is working on, is sort of culling individuals, and you're a virus inside a host, say a rabbit, then if you want to do better than all the rest of the viruses around you in the population, you will want to be as virulent as possible, right? However, if the now there is this arms race that leads to hypervirulence, then there's a good chance that all the virus population will die in the body of the host, of the rabbit, because the rabbit will be so sick that it won't have time to go and procreate and sort of any further. On the other hand, if the virulence is attenuated, then the entire population will be better off, because then this rabbit will go have sex with another rabbit, and they will pass into further generations. So there's a conflict between the individual and the group, and the price equation allows one to see how natural selection works in these kind of cases.
The success of this equation rests on his realization that populations really consist of a nested hierarchy of units.
That's right.
They're the individuals within groups, groups within populations, and it goes on and on and on.
That's right. That's right. So for much of the time, ever since Darwin, those who tried to crack this problem thought that natural selection had to be working at one level at one time, whether at the level of the gene, you know, natural selection was selecting the gene, or it was selecting the individual, or selecting the group, or the lineage, or perhaps the cell. But what the equation allows us to see is that actually natural selection is one big giant eye which sees everything all the time simultaneously and works at all levels simultaneously.
This sounds like game theory to some degree.
Indeed. Price was, in fact, the first person, together with John Maynard Smith, whom you just mentioned, to apply the tenets of game theory to the evolution of animal behavior. He wrote a very, what is now a famous paper, was published in Nature in 1973, called The Logic of Animal Conflict. And that paper tried to explain how it is that when you have male deer fighting over territory or females, that they engage in this ritualized battle rather than really hurting each other. They lock their antlers, and within a very short span of time, the victor is allowed to seize the vanquished, leaving the territory without having really incurred any kind of injury. So Price wanted to ask, how could this kind of sort of attenuated violence have evolved over time? And he used game theory for the first time to try to explain this.
Is his equation now generally accepted by the scientific community?
It took a while, as I said, for the scientific community to understand the equation. And the opening scene of the book is George Price's funeral, where there are less than 10 people there, about 10 people there, six of whom are hobos and derelicts, his last companions, the people on whom he had descended like a saint when he decided to try to actualize a program of radical altruism. So at the time of his death, besides Maynard Smith and Hamilton, who were the two greatest evolutionary biologists of the era, no one really knew about this. And
you say that, but you say that when he showed it, the first person he showed it to immediately got him a job. So some people must have recognized that something important was in that equation.
It was a very small number of people, and some of them really didn't. They understood that this was a very, very deep penetration, but didn't quite understand the meaning of it.
My guest is Oren Harman, who's the chair of the Graduate Program in Science, Technology, and Society at Bar-Ilan University and a professor of the history of science. His latest book is called The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for Origins of Kindness, published by Norton. Stay with us for more. Later on in this hour, we'll take a look at the life and legacy of the legendary record producer Phil Spector, from his work with the Ronettes, the Righteous Brothers, and the Beatles, to his trial for murder. Plus, Charles Ogletree with a look at what last year's arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. says about race, class, and crime in America. And reminded that this week the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. You can see and hear gavel-to-gavel coverage streamed live at WNYC.org. And tune in each night for NPR's wrap-up of the day's hearings at 8 p.m. on AM 820 WNYC. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Orrin Harmon, whose latest book does a little wordplay in its title. It's about George Price and the search for the origins of kindness, and he's called the book The Price of Altruism. It's published by Norton. You talked about how Price really wasn't all that well-known, but wasn't his desire to become well-known? He felt that if he could come up with something really important, then he would be published, and then his career would be made.
Yeah, Price was a very socially awkward, strange man, incredibly brilliant. But more than anything, he really wanted to make one great penetration, have one great insight, one great discovery that would make his name. And it really didn't matter to him in what field. So at one point in his life, he was corresponding with about five Nobel laureates, each in different fields. And he was a complete unknown again.
And perhaps what was hurting him is that he wasn't a specialist. He was an outsider in all of those fields. But you suggest that he could just as easily have tried to solve a problem in an entirely different area of science. He just happened to come across this one. That's why he thought about coincidences so much.
Well, with Price, I think that there's actually a strong connection between the vicissitudes of his own life and his own personal matters and the decision to try to crack the evolution of altruism, because he had been a bad family man. He broke up with his wife, who was incredibly religious, and he was an atheist.
Left her with a couple of daughters.
Left her with a couple of daughters. And then when he had this breakdown in the mid-60s, he began thinking about the evolution of family, how family had come about in evolutionary time. And it was through the attempt to understand the origin of family that he reached the mathematics of altruism.
But I want to go back. You talked about his anger about a botched operation. He developed a thyroid tumor after he'd worked on the Manhattan Project. I don't know if there was a direct link, because he had been working with radiation.
Right.
And then he worked on helping to develop medical radiation therapy for cancer patients some years later at a medical school in Minnesota. So there's a connection there. But the real problem occurs when a friend of his, a surgeon named Don Ferguson, performed a radical operation to remove his thyroid in 1966.
Yes,
what happened?
A little bit earlier than that. It was just a botched operation. The operation was actually successful from the point of view of oncology. Got the tumor out. But it left him debilitated in one of his shoulders and arms.
And he came to hate his friend.
He came to hate him. He had a very strong reaction to this and decided that life wasn't worth living and that he was going to give it one more go by traveling across the Atlantic and trying to solve a great mystery.
He even came to believe that his friend had used the surgery to deliberately damage him?
Yeah. Price was not 100% stable.
Well, he'd had brushes with mental illness all along, a number of suicide attempts.
That's right. That's right. And it's very interesting how often in the history of science, not only in the history of science, but also in sort of history of knowledge more generally, people who are not quote-unquote normal, who are different from the rest of us, often are able to make very, very deep penetrations that apply to all of us. And it's that sort of outside eye or a different kind of mind that allows a different and new, novel, genuinely original approach to difficult problems.
Did he ever seek treatment? Did he ever go to a psychiatrist?
He did a bit, but not that much in New York City before coming to England.
And then later it's been suggested that he might have been schizophrenic.
I don't know. It's tough to make diagnoses, especially historically. But what happened to Price after he wrote this equation was that he began to think about the meaning of the equation itself. And to him, and to his very special mind, what the equation meant was that if you could write a mathematical equation explaining the evolution of a trait like altruism, what it meant about altruism was that it could never be genuine and pure. There was no true selflessness born by evolution. And this was really a very difficult realization for him to make, because it meant that there was no real benevolence in this world. And at that point, George decided to try to, as it were, to beat his own mathematics, to try to transcend what nature had told him through maths by proving via his own actions in his own life that true selflessness could in fact exist in this world. And that's what drove him to the streets of London to help the hobos.
It does seem ironic that, as you point out in your book, George Price's life seemed to become more difficult and unhappier after he developed this equation, which establishes him as an important person in the history of science.
Right, because thinking about its philosophical meanings led him to very, very deep caverns of depression.
And then he just stops being a militant atheist?
Well, at this point, he embraces God, having come to the conclusion that if he was, out of everyone since Darwin, was able to come up with this very beautiful short equation, what this surely meant was that he had been chosen by God to tell a very deep truth to humanity. And this is where his sort of Christian love comes in. At this point, he said, I will show via my actions that what science teaches us about kindness can be transcended by the Spirit.
Well, how long after his conversion did he begin to give away his money, his possessions, and even his clothes?
About 2 years after he converted, he began inviting homeless people into his homes. And there's a very poignant letter that he wrote to John Maynard Smith, one of the great evolutionists of the age, saying, I'm down to my last 15p, and I can't wait to give away my last 15p, because this was to him the evidence that true selflessness was actually possible. Of course, it led ultimately to him losing everything and having to leave his own home and live rough in the streets, just like the vagabonds that he had set out to help.
Well, first he began sleeping in his office in the Department of Human Genetics at the University College, the University of London.
Right.
I can't imagine what his colleagues thought. And then homeless people started bringing them to the school.
Right. They started showing up and sort of throwing beer bottles and cussing. And one of them came into the department and started pissing on the linoleum floor.
They fought with the students.
And there were some altercations with the students. And, George, being an outsider, not many people knew him at UCL. And as he became weirder and weirder, people just didn't understand what was happening. In the streets, of course, no one knew who George was, and no one knew that he had made this great penetration. So when I tracked down some of the homeless people who knew him in the streets in the 70s for the purpose of writing this book and told them who George Price was, they were astonished. They had no idea who he was.
Were they all still homeless?
Well, not the ones that I met. Some of them had sort of picked themselves up and began their lives anew.
My guest is Orrin Harmon, whose latest book is The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ledith Lopate. I have the sense that George Price is still not famous in the world of science, despite his achievement. How did you first learn about him?
Well, being a student of biology, I was familiar with what was known as the Price equation. But then I read a short little article that told a story of a mysterious American who had moved to England, written an equation that explains altruism, and then killed himself. And the article seemed to suggest that there was some connection between the equation and the suicide, but that it really hadn't been worked out. And so I began a journey via circuitous ways of finding Price's family, especially his two daughters, where his papers exist in their dens in California. These papers were actually rescued by Hamilton, who, after Price's suicide in the squat in the slum, fought his way into the squat and took all the papers and sent them back to America.
Had they had any contact with him after he abandoned them
and
their mother?
They did. They actually came to visit him in London in the early 70s, and unbeknownst to them, he was trying to convert them to evangelical Christianity as well. He was trying to do that to Hamilton, too, who was a complete atheist, and there was no chance that he was going to succeed.
Well, how did they remember him then?
Well, they thought of him as a quirky, very brilliant, sort of fun character because their mother was very staid and religious, and it wasn't all that fun, apparently, growing up with her alone in the home. So whenever they met George, he was somewhere else exciting, you know, whether it was at IBM or Bell Labs or then in bopping London of the Beatles of the late 60s and early 70s. So they remembered him quite fondly. But the touching thing about writing this book is that I was, of course, very... I didn't know what the daughters would think of what I wrote because they didn't know all the story I had unearthed. And when I finally sent it to them, they called me up, both of them, and said that it really, really touched them to know all the story. So they think of him very fondly and with very good memories.
And George wrote to his ex-wife, Julia, years later after his religious conversion, asked her to marry him again. How did you respond to the proposal? Had religion been one of the factors in their breakup in the first place?
It surely had, which was one of the reasons why George thought that he would be able to win her back. But her reply was a resounding no. I mean, she saw that George was already sort of flipping, and he was on the other side. And although it hurt her, she had to say no to him.
Now, I get the sense that you're suggesting that after he came up with the equation, he went into some kind of a tailspin, and that ended ultimately with the suicide. But he was a suicidal type. I mean, he had attempted a number of times. He tried to cut his throat with a scissor at one point before that. So perhaps there was always this battle between the person who could actually get things accomplished and the person who was going to be overwhelmed by his emotional problem.
Right. Well, he hadn't tried to cut himself with a knife. That's how he killed himself. Mm. What he had done before was, having undergone this conversion, he stopped taking his thyroid meds because he figured, if I've really been chosen by God to tell this great truth about kindness to humanity and I don't take my pills and I live, that would be a sure sign that I've been chosen. So, yes, he did have this proclivity, but I think that...
Well, he made threats to kill himself.
That's right. But despite the proclivity, there was in his mind, in his very unusual mind, a connection between the signs that he had described and the sort of philosophical meanings that he took out from it.
What did he say in the... He left four notes at the end. What did he say in them?
He said, "I've become a burden on my friends, and so I have to leave." He wrote a note to a loved one, a very young, sort of beautiful, fetching American artist whom he had met in the square in Kentish Town, saying that he loved her and he's sorry. It's a very, very sad story in the end of the day. It's a tragic story.
And how old was he at the time?
54 years old.
The picture on the cover of your book is of a rather good-looking young man.
Very good-looking young man. But if you see pictures within the book towards the final chapters, you'll see that he really deteriorated. He was down to skin and bones, looked like a scarecrow, was walking the streets mumbling things about Jesus, and no one, absolutely no one, knew who this man was walking amongst them.
And that he was buried in an unmarked grave.
Until this very day in St. Pancras in London.
This is a very sad story.
It's sad, but there's also something uplifting about it. Maybe we can end with this. And that is that George Price's story really teaches us that despite the majesty of science and how, despite the fact that science is such a powerful tool with which we come to learn the world, there are some things that are really beyond the grasp of science. Some things that once we've answered all our scientific questions, we still will not have scratched, as Wittgenstein wrote in his Tractatus. And matters of the spirit, like the true motivations behind acts of kindness, may be something that we will never plummet. We will never understand completely. And I actually find that somewhat hopeful.
Aaron Harmon's book is The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. It's published by W.W. Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
Orrin Harmon will be reading and signing books next Wednesday at 7 at Book Culture. That's at 536 West 112th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. Up next, director Vikram Jayanti discusses his new documentary, which looks at the legacy of record producer Phil Spector, the creator of the Wall of Sound that defined some of the greatest hits from the 1960s, and who's now serving a 19-year sentence for murder. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.